Good afternoon, students, both MA students and BA students, MA students in European Studies and BA students in political science. We got international relations, we got governance, and we got the sociology, right? And humanity as well, right? And public administration in this class. Today is very special because we're going to listen to the most recent updated information about the protest, the demonstration in Ukraine and another country that we have no knowledge about it at all, which is a small country. It's a former Soviet Union, Moldova. And I've got my two good friends there. Before that, they were my colleagues. But when you got colleagues as friends, it's much better, right? We are bonding and we exchanging a lot. The first speaker is Sebastian Schaeffer. Okay. Sebastian is the founder of the NSC Europe. And the NSC Europe is a very important think tank that organizes seminar, workshop, and also the government advisor service. Sebastian is a specialist in the Danube region and the former Yugoslavian states, like the Balkan. The Western Balkan countries. Well, he got so many titles. He is a member of the Academic Council of the Munich European Forum. So the guy in European Studies. Okay, my hand is shaking because so many posts. And Sebastian, well, teach a lot. He teach before he stayed in Vienna. He teach in Göttingen, Germany. And in Greifswald. And in Greifswald important because it is a former East Germany part, right? So he's very good at this socialism, post-socialist transformation. Well, Sebastian got honors master degree in East European Studies from Regensburg. And Regensburg, I think, is the first town which we have the sausage store. You know that? You know German is very important of sausage. And the oldest sausage shop is in Regensburg. It's next to the Donau or Danube River. It's very delicious. Okay, good at food. And he got an undergrad 2 degree from Munich, Ludwig Maximilian University in political science, law, and Slavonic studies, which is very good at our Russian area. Okay, thank you, Sebastian. And then the second speaker, Iris Krakow. Okay. Iris is associate at SSC Europe. She's a Moldova specialist. Oh my god, she got 3 degrees from sociology, political science, and pedagogy from 3 countries. Tübingen, Germany, Granada, España, Spain, I try to be Spanish, and Leipzig, Germany. And she worked for the Leonardo da Vinci program of the EU in Portugal. So it's very exotic because Iris Award is a neurospecialist and Latin American specialist. And she worked for the DRRD in Moldova for many years. She observed the transition, the change, the call for democracy in Moldova. And her area was on very interesting cultural communication, grassroots journalism, and migration. And today, well, I'm asking them why it's gray. I try to figure out because in the call for democracy, we call it as a color revolution. Any color, do you know? Have you heard about orange? Where is it? Orange Revolution, Ukraine, right? And you got Rose Revolution in Georgia, and you try to turn it as a color revolution. And now they start to coin gray. And I'm asking them, why is gray? They say that I won't tell you. We won't tell you. You're going to tell them, right? Anyhow. Okay, so gray is not a color, but when it's gray, it sounds not that pleasant, right? And demonstrations in Chișinău, which is a capital city of Moldova, and Euromaidan in Kiev. Consequences for the EU-Russia relations in the context of Eastern Partnership. Okay, I talk too much, so I give the floor to Sebastian and Iris.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much for giving us the opportunity to actually speak here. As you said, it is always a pleasure when you can combine work and friendship, and it's a great thing that we are here. It's my first time. I've been teaching a lot, I've been lecturing a lot in Eastern Europe, in Germany, Northern Africa, but never in Asia. I have summer schools where Chinese students attend, but they come. And I am very pleased that we have the opportunity to speak. And for me, as I said, it's the first time that I have the opportunity to speak at the university in Thailand. So it's a great honor. It's a great pleasure for us to update you on the things that I already mentioned. What I can tell you is that it's not going to be about my suit. So it's a gray suit, but the title has nothing to do with this. Nevertheless, we want to keep you keen, so you will find out in the course of this lecture why the title is called Grey is Not a Color. Before we jump in, just very briefly, I want to point your attention to SSE Europe, Seminar Simulations Consulting Europe. It's a company that I started 5 years ago, and as it has already been mentioned, we are doing a lot of civic education, political education, lecturers, seminars, and also governmental relations. If you're interested in what we do, and if you want to follow what we do, I cordially invite you to check our Facebook page or our homepage. I don't think that you need to write down everything, because you can use this presentation and distribute it if you like to. So we can have your full attention. And there is no train of thought that I am following. So if something is unclear, if I do not speak proper English, if you cannot understand what is happening, please feel free to interrupt us at any time. Just raise your hand, and we're going to clarify questions, because we don't want to lose you throughout the presentation. There will be a couple of things that we are going to talk about, and the agenda is as follows. We will first of all give you an overview about the cooperation and competition between the European Union and the Russian Federation. We will then have a look at the Eastern Partnership and the Eurasian Economic Union. We will then switch to the Republic of Moldova, where Iris is going to tell you a bit more about the demonstrations. Then I am going to continue with Ukraine. We both have been in those countries, and the pictures that you're going to see are actually pictures that we took when we were in Kiev, respectively Chișinău. We will then have a brief excursion to something that is called Novorossiya, and in the end we will give you an overview over the future of the EU-Russia relations. And afterwards, we gladly then answer your questions. But before you ask us questions, I want to ask you a question. Who do you think is more dangerous, Assad or Putin? Assad, former prime minister, current prime minister, we don't know, of Syria. Vladimir Putin, Prime Minister, Prime Minister, President, Prime Minister, and then President again of the Russian Federation. So who's more dangerous? Putin, okay. Who's more dangerous, Assad or Merkel? She's the Chancellor of Germany. Assad? Okay. So, who is more dangerous than Putin or Merkel? Putin. Okay. We will answer this question at the very end of our lecture. So, until then, maybe your perception changes a bit. Anyway, let's get started. You have to see that geographically, the Russian Federation considers the shared neighborhood with the European Union, so the neighbor states that they both border, as their own sphere of influence. They coined the term near abroad, and we can see a cartoon here, abroad a couple more. This cartoon depicts this Russian sphere of influence, and you can see a Russian tank rolling over Georgia, what happened in 2008, and the European Union standing by and saying they are going to retreat. Now, this is something that the European Union apparently is implementing a lot nowadays, standing by and observing and watching, but not acting. We have an economic power of the Russian Federation that wants to extend this, of course, onto its neighbors, mainly, most important, the natural resources. This is why it is actually really harmful for the Russian economy that the oil price is so low at the moment. We have a military power. I always mentioned the Black Sea Fleet that was stationed in Ukraine. And now, if you ask me, it's still stationed in Ukraine, but nevertheless, the Russian Federation considers it now being stationed in the Russian Federation due to the annexation of Crimea. And we have frozen conflicts. We had old frozen conflicts, Armenia, Azerbaijan. We had the old frozen conflicts, Abkhazia, South Ossetia with Georgia. And we also had the frozen conflicts, Transnistria with Moldova. And now we have a potential new frozen conflict that is going to emerge in eastern Ukraine. And I put a question mark there, because sometimes the Russian Federation acts as a mediator, but sometimes it actually also acts as an aggressor. So we have already mentioned the war with Georgia, and I also would call it a war with Ukraine, although it is not nominally a war that was declared from the Russian Federation to Ukraine, because from a Russian point of view, there are no Russian troops that are stationed there, although in some statements Vladimir Putin admitted that now some of these tiny green men that came across the border are actual Russian soldiers. So, having in mind that the Russian Federation is an important player in the near abroad between the European Union and the Kremlin, we have several areas of cooperation. I have only listed four of them. There is more than 40 initiatives, regional but also international, where the Russian Federation and member countries of the European Union, or the whole European Union itself, are part of it. One of the first ones is the Partnership and Cooperation Agreement that has been signed in 1997 between the European Union and the Russian Federation. It ended in 2007, and they are still struggling to come up with a new one, but it will be prolonged every time if it's not cancelled by one of the parties for 1 year. In this Partnership and Cooperation Agreement, there are also an extension to something that is called the Four Common Spaces. I don't have the time to go into too much detail, but the basic idea was, at that time, the Russian Federation doesn't want to be part of the European Neighborhood Policy that was drawn up in 2003, because they wanted to have a partnership at eye level, not to be a part of all the neighboring countries of the European Union. So they created the four common spaces. We also have the Northern Dimension. What you can see in very various EU programs that they are centered along waters. So the Northern Dimension is centered around the countries of the Baltic Sea. So it's the Scandinavian countries, the Baltic countries, and the Russian Federation, plus Norway. And the Black Sea Synergy is, of course, centered around the Black Sea, where when Romania and Bulgaria became a member of the European Union in 2007, a new water opened up for the European Union, and within the Black Sea Synergy, there's also cooperation between European Union member countries and the Russian Federation. And we have the BSEC, which is not a European Union organization, but an international organization, and they are, but they are also European Union member countries that are participating. So, various areas of cooperation, but two areas of competition. The one is the Eastern Partnership from the side of the European Union, and the other one is the Eurasian Union from the side of the Kremlin. Now, the Eastern Partnership was designed in 2009 to actually extend the European Neighborhood Policy and serve as an Eastern Dimension. So the blue colored countries are members of the European Union, and the orange colored countries are the target countries, Armenia, Azerbaijan, Belarus, Georgia, Moldova, and Ukraine. It was something that had the initiative to have summits every 2 years. Not much was happening on those summits, but the 2013 summit became very infamous in the sense that basically this was the starting point for the Euromaidan revolution that happened in Ukraine. Now, the basic idea behind the Eastern Partnership is to have foreign ministers meeting once a year, a parliamentary assembly where you meet with different parliamentarians, and also a local and regional authorities assembly to bring together regional actors from the target countries' areas, but also help them to bring them closer to the European Union. Main goals: we have the creation of the necessary conditions to accelerate political association and further economic integration between the EU and the partner countries. So the basic idea was to say, if we want those countries to be potentially ready in 10, 20 years to become a member of the European Union, we have to start with the reforms now. And the reforms function in different areas. The idea is to support the political and socio-economical reforms, also facilitating this approximation to the European Union, but also bring those countries closer together. Main parts of it consist of the DCFTA, the Deep and Comprehensive Free Trade Agreement, and visa liberalization. But we will hear about this point a bit later when we come to the example of Moldova. So now, in 2009, we had the start of the Eastern Partnership, but it drew back much longer when it came to the European Neighborhood Policy. In 2015, we had the formal launch of the Eurasian Economic Union, which is supposed to be the Eurasian Union sooner or later. It's a brainchild of Putin's presidency candidacy in 2011, where he fostered the relations. We can see the former president, now prime minister, Dmitry Medvedev in the middle, when an agreement between Belarus, Lukashenko on the left side, and Nursultan Nazarbayev from Kazakhstan on the right side, where they settled an agreement to establish this Eurasian Union by 2015. We can trace it back to actually the middle of the 1990s, where it was proposed that we need some sort of successor organization to the then collapsed Soviet Union. And this was revitalized with this idea of Putin, and we can see that we already draw from various existing points where the Eurasian Union is supposed to be a real counterpart to the European Union. We had a common economic space already, which was on the basis, in 2012, created on the basis of the customs union between Russia, Belarus, and Kazakhstan. We also have a Eurasian Commission that is modeled to the European Commission. And we also have regional organizations that can serve as a further basis. We have the Union State of Russia and Belarus. When you are in the airport in Moscow, Domodedovo, you can see there is a line for the passport control. There's a line for citizens of the Union State of Russia and Belarus. There is a line for the members of the Commonwealth of Independent States. There is a line for the ones who are participating in the then common economic space, and then there is all others, which is kind of odd when you look at all these different lines that are there. We have also the Collective Security Treaty Organization. Have the CIS that I mentioned. So there is a lot of things that they can already build on, and it is fostering and going on. We had in 2014 the signing of the treaty establishing this Eurasian Economic Union. We also had Ukraine as a potential target country, and when they then wanted to sign the association agreement at the Vilnius summit of the Eastern Partnership in 2013, this came down to the point where we are actually now with the demonstrations in Kiev. And finally, on January 1st, 2015, the Eurasian Economic Union was established, and we have parts now Armenia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Russia. The treaties with Kyrgyzstan are signed, and Uzbekistan and Tajikistan have already expressed that they want to become part of it as well. Something very odd that happened recently in the course of the intervention of the Russian Federation in Syria. They started to now sort of bomb. We're not sure who. We have to understand that Assad is one of the last allies that the Kremlin has in the Middle East. And there are actually talks going on that are rumored that even Syria, when the Russians brought peace, is a potential candidate to join this Eurasian Economic Union, which would make it quite interesting, but this is something for the future to see. Now, if you look at the map of the former USSR, which is the big red line, and the target countries, you can see that we have the countries that are already participating. We also have the shared neighborhood with the European Union, which is disputed. And we have also rumors that are targeting the former Baltic countries. So what we see is that it is really only this tiny strip here on the very left side that separates the Russian Federation and the European Union, and they're both with their ideas of how to actually bring countries together in a supranational organization. It is very clear, though, that while the European Union, and I'm not saying this because I am a citizen of a European Union member country, it's just a fact, if you look at the institutional settings, that while Brussels, the center of the European Union, is aiming at bringing countries together under the motto United in Diversity, that the center of this Eurasian Union is going to be in Moscow and is going to be Russian dominated. That is the first part, and now we're going to jump to the tiniest of the countries that you can see on this map, the Republic of Moldova, and I'll hand over to Iris.
Thank you for being here. I'm very happy to tell you a bit about the tiny country Moldova. First of all, I want to start to show you where Moldova is. Can you point it? There? Yes. So, Moldova, it's really a small country in between Romania and Ukraine. It's landlocked, so no access to the sea. It's more or less in between Brussels and Moscow, because for both on both sides it's 1,500 kilometers to reach the capitals of the Eurasian Union and the European Union. And in Moldova you really can see the problems a tiny, small country has to be in between these systems. Moldova is a former Soviet republic, and the Declaration of Independence was in August 1991. Chisinau is the capital, and the whole country has more or less 3 million residents, inhabitants. The problem is that more or less one quarter of the population is abroad for working or studying, and they have this migration coming back to their country, going back to most of the time Russia or Italy or Spain. And this problem is really big for the country, because a lot of children, they live in incomplete families because the parents are abroad. Another thing is what you can see on the left side, there is a river and there is Transnistria. So they say it's an extra republic in the country of Moldova. I have another one. The capital there is Tiraspol. Here you can see, so you have Moldova, and Chisinau is another way of spelling. And then Transnistria, a tiny, tiny country. Only half a million inhabitants, and also locked between Moldova and Ukraine. After the Declaration of Independence, they had a war, a civil war between Moldova and Transnistria. More than 1,000 people were killed, so on both sides. And since then, it's a de facto regime ruled by more or less oligarchs. So they have a parliament, but there is a sheriff group, so they call the company is called Sheriff, because the leaders been policemen before, so they call their company Sheriff, and they have the petrol station, the magazines, TV station, what else? The biggest football club, the only Mercedes-Benz shop. So they have, yeah, they have more or less everything. And in the country, they have their own currency called ruble, like the Russian one, and they have own passports, but they are not connected to any other country. So only Russia is not saying, and this is a country. So it's still Moldova, but yeah, it's a de facto regime. And it's supported from Russia with gas and a lot of money. And but now the situation is really bad because of the problems in Ukraine. So Ukraine said it's not allowed to pass through because they are afraid that the problems in eastern Ukraine will go more in the west. And the economy is going down. Absolutely. So this was a small excursion about Transnistria. Let's talk about the whole Moldova. The political system is unicameral Moldovan parliament, 101 seats. The elections normally are, as how is it planned, every 4 years. And now the president is Nicolae Timofti. He will be, or there will be new elections in April this year. So we will see what's going on then there. But now he is still in charge. And now we have a new prime minister. When I made this this political system sheet, there was no prime minister. Since 1 week, Moldova has a new one, and his name is, let me check again, Pavel Filip. So he was voted in a really, let's say, interesting way. So it was midnight last week, and not all of the parliament was there, and nobody was informed, not the press, so nobody, but some people, they figured out, okay, what's going on in the parliament, and they started to attack the parliament, and then the parliamentees inside has been, they could go out in policemen uniforms, so it was really, really strange, and the people are really annoyed how politics is working or is not working in Moldova. And in 1 year, so since February last year, it's the fifth prime minister in Moldova. So you can see it's maybe 2 months, or in June there was only 4 weeks that the prime minister was in charge. And then he said, okay, I go, and then again, the next one. So it's really absolutely not working at the moment. Let's go to the protests. So as Sebastian said, I was there in September, October last year. I explain now maybe why gray is not a color. We said, when I was there in October, we had the demonstrations. Let's say at this time 5,000 or 6,000 people. I was there walking around talking to the people, and then I said, okay, to be honest, it's not like, for example, in the Euromaidan, where a lot of young people fought for their rights, so like students and young people, let's say young in this case, under 40. In Moldova, most of the protesters had the age of, let's say, 50, 60, or even older. So that's why I said, okay, gray is not a color, because I saw only people with gray hair. So no youngsters, not at all. But normally, if you want to make a revolution, or if you want to change something, you need the young people, because they bring the inspiration, they bring the, let's say, the power. If you are 50, 60, or older, you are old. So it's really, you can change, but it's not for your future. So why to fight for what? So that's because we said gray is not a color. And also compared to the Orange Revolution, for example, where the young people went to the place and wanted to change a bit. The reasons for the protest. In November 2014, maybe 2 weeks before the last elections, there was a loss, let's call it loss, of $1 billion. So, and this is 1/5 of the GDP from Moldova, so it's really a huge amount of money. And this happened because the three banks, they gave loans uncovered, and now the money is gone. Nobody knows where the money is, but it's gone. The banks are right now not existing anymore, so one is, let's say, finished, but the others are still there, and the money is maybe on the Bahamas, Bermudas, I don't know. And this was the first thing that people said, okay, no, it's our money. What are you doing with the money? And then they found the main reason is that we have a lot of corruption in all the parts of personal and business life. So I teach at the university, and you can buy your qualification, you can buy your certificates. It's no problem. If you go to a doctor, you have to pay. So it doesn't matter if you are in the insurance, you have to pay, otherwise, okay. Yeah, bad luck for you, but that's the way it goes. And this leads to unstable political and economical system, and they had a crisis in 2009 and again last year. The interesting part is in the protests, not only that it's a grey revolution or not revolution, it's also who is who. So who are the demonstrators? And you can say it's divided in between pro-Romanian, pro-Russian and pro-EU, and then the big group of people who say we don't want to have the oligarchs. And on this sheet, you can see younger group from all Romanians. You can see Renato Buzati on one side. He's now a mayor in Wels. He's connected to Russia. He made a lot of money. Nobody knows how, but he did in Russia. Now he's back in Moldova, making politics somehow, but with a lot of money, and he pays his protesters to be there because they are in tents and it's really cold in Moldova right now, and he pays them. And on the other side, it's Vlad Filat. He was a former prime minister, or he is. But now he is, at this time he wasn't, but now he is arrested because they said it's your fault that the money is gone, the 1 billion. To be honest, I'm not sure if he's only, or if he is the only one who is responsible for the loss. But it was really interesting how he got to jail. This is the next oligarch who did this, the most wanted one. You can see on the top is Plahotniuk, because he really pushed the policeman to in jail. Vladimir Plahotniuk is the most important, the people say, bandit in Moldova. He owns also television station, magazines, a lot of shops, etc., etc. And he is, he wants to be a politician, he wanted to be a prime minister, and he asked for this 3 weeks ago. But the current president said, no, you are not able to be one. And now prime minister is a really good friend of Vlad Plahotniuk. So it's always how politics in Moldova goes. So if you know someone, yeah, that's the oligarch and corruption thing. Moldova is signed the association agreement 1.5 years ago. I was there, and there was a big party at the main square. The people, they really celebrated it, and they have the trade agreement. And Moldova was called, like, the country is the front runner. So you will be able to be part of the European Union maybe in 10 years. But since this 18 month, the situation changed completely. So now it's really a problem child. In between, the people are so unhappy to be in the country, they leave, like the working migration and the brain drain. So if you are a teacher at university, your income is so low, you really can't live from this, so you have to have more jobs than only one or two. So most of my colleagues, they had four jobs to survive. And the country itself needs the remittances from the people abroad. But this makes also the problem that the country, the government, they don't want to keep the people in the country. So they also, they push to go abroad for the money. The high level of corruption, and this increases a social inequality and a total dissatisfaction. So now the situation is that Moldova itself, most of the people, they speak Romanian and Russian, but some only Romanian, some Russian, so that's also divides the country. And now is the question, okay, do we go further to the EU direction? But the people are disappointed from the EU because there was the Greece crisis and the migration problem in Europe, so the EU had no focus on Moldova. Or do we go to the Eurasian Union, to the Russian Federation? And they really, they do it in another way. So they give money, they give cheap gas. So they, what's this called? They try to lure them. And we will see what will be next. So tomorrow on Friday there is like an ultimatum that what do the government, so the people on the central square, they want that they have new elections. And tomorrow is a really important day because then the government has to say yes, no, what's next. And Plahotniuk, I'm quite sure that he is not complete with the situation now, so he will be maybe the next president, hopefully not, but if, then you can say he really bought the country. So he's only, it's all about money, it's all about economy in the worst way you can have, and just so close to the European Union. Yeah, it's really a shame. So for me, I was there, and to see what happens in only 2 years, we will see what's going on next. And now it's your turn again to talk about Ukraine.
Thank you. So although it is a very tiny country, and you probably have never heard about it, try to follow what is going on in the next couple of days, because it's going to be very interesting. It is going to be a bit different, nevertheless, what is the outcome than it has been with Ukraine, and I'm going to show you why. So, again here, okay, this is not a very good map. Anyways, Ukraine is located there. Looks like this. We have Ukraine also being a former Soviet Republic. We have the Declaration of Independence as well in 1991. Kiev is the capital, and we have a bit more than 40 million inhabitants. So compared to Moldova, Ukraine is much, much bigger. And the current figures are without Crimea, which is still contested what is actually going to happen there. Anyway, now, the Euromaidan, I already mentioned we had the intention of President Yanukovych to sign the association agreement with the European Union, and then 2 days before that, or a week before that signing, he withdrew his consent. We can only assume that it was pressure from the Kremlin that led to this. But the people then were unhappy and gathered on the Maidan, the central square in the capital Kiev. On the 21st November in 2013, we have then on the 30th of November, Berkut special police units attacking and dispersing all the protesters. But on the next day, peaceful protests continued. We have, again, in December, then the third Sunday, who in a row the mass protests broke out. Something that was also is also happening in Moldova. We have Sunday as a typical day where the people would come and gather. And we have then, 3 days later, thousands of troops and Berglut, the special police units, surrounding on the square, clear with the intention to clear out all the protesters, tear down the barricades and the encampments. And it was a determined and unexpected crackdown on the protesters, as it was described from people being there. And on the next day, these barricades were rebuilt again, and there was no longer any room, because the more and more people gathered and came together. And we had, on 18th of February, 20,000 Euromaidan protesters advancing towards Ukraine's parliament in order to roll back the constitution, something that is also, again, similar what happened, for instance, in the protests in 2009 in Chisinau, and also now when there were rumors about Plahotniuc being elected, and also this dubious midnight election of Philip, where protesters marched towards the parliament. Subsequently, after this, and this is the big difference, the Euromaidan protesters were successful. President Yanukovych fled the country. We had a clear line of division between pro European Union approximation and the ones who, on the protesters' side, and the government who wanted to not sign the association agreement but align with the Russian Federation. Whereas in Chisinau, the lines are not very clear. You can't draw them simply between pro-Russian and pro-European. In the Western media, you can observe that it is often said that those protests are pro-Russian because the current government is pro-EU, or used to be. We're still not sure what the recent government plans are. But the lines are not that easily drawn in Chisinau and Moldova. I also brought you a screenshot where Facebook was very vital. Mustafa Nayem, I had a chance to meet him actually last year in December, was the one who said that they should gather at the Maidan and come together via a Facebook post. And this is what started all of this. Mustafa Nayem is now a member of parliament. He is responsible for the police reform in Ukraine. And I'm just going to leave that here for interpretation.
You are his friend on Facebook.
No, I'm not his friend on Facebook. No. But this is something that you can find. Yeah. So you see that. And this is what started it all. Again, sometimes revolution swallow their children, and now he is a member of the party from Petro Poroshenko, who is the current president of Ukraine. Nevertheless, we'll see what will come out of this. Mustafa Nayem and his Facebook post started this, where you can see that social media is very vital in that case to bring those people together, young people. Yeah, you can't imagine that the many, many grey-haired people that gather in Chisinau are organized via Facebook, because they probably have never heard about Facebook in their lives. So there is again a difference. Key role of the social media in the case of Ukraine, whereas it's rather word of mouth, and who has the biggest kettle with soup that is handed out in the protesters' camps in Chisinau. So subsequently what happened, you can see a couple of pictures, again taken during the time when we have been there, apart from the burning ones, to be honest. But you can see the aftermath on the top right picture, the burned out hotel. You can see also commemorating the fallen hero 100 that have died during the protests, which also gave a different spin, a different triggering event to the whole thing. The violent crackdown of the protests in Kiev that brought back more and more and more people, where we do not have this crackdown in the case of Moldova. So what happened? Yeah, the Euromaidan was the gathering because Yanukovych would not sign the association agreement, and this revolution of dignity, which it is coined now, which was following because those people were killed, the protesters were killed, the reforms wanted to be taken back. So it spun into something different, into a revolution. We can see that now the barricades have been removed, although they extended until August, although in February Yanukovych already left the country. We have also various non-governmental organizations that came out of this Maidan, SOS for instance, who is caring for what is happening with the civil society. We also have the mentioned bloc, Petro Poroshenko, who is now president and also has the biggest amount of seats in the Ukrainian parliament. We have also Vitaly Klitschko, former boxing world champion, who is now the mayor of Kiev. So you see various stages. I mean, revolution, when you take it in its original meaning, it's actually turning things back to how they have been. But we use the term revolution in many ways with this colorful revolutions in the CIS, but also in former Yugoslavia, and changing basically everything upside down what was in power before. And this is again something that we cannot see in Moldova, because it's the same people over and over again who are participating in the political process, whereas we still don't know where Yanukovych is right now, somewhere in Russia hiding, and he is out of power and he has no chance to ever come back into government. So but then out of this also the Crimean crisis came, and also the war in the Donbas area. You can see here the airport in Donetsk, who is completely destroyed. It was recently renovated for the European Football Championship in 2012. Now Crimea is annexed by the Russian Federation. We have still fighting in eastern Ukraine going on, centered around the People's Republic of Donetsk and Lugansk. So the revolution truly was something that brought change in the country, but also had an effect on the international arena. Whereas, for instance, the revolution in Chisinau has not, sometimes makes it into news, but is not something that is expected to bring about the same change as it has been in Ukraine. But there is a political thinking going on from a Russian, I don't want to say bad things about people, because this is going to be on tape, but this guy is not very clear in his head from time to time, I would think. But nevertheless, there are rumors that those plans about his Novo Russia thinking are having a certain type of influence on the Kremlin's politics. So this term floats around. We have we have to go back in history. If we look at the Russian Empire at the end of the 19th century, this new Russia was what is basically now Ukraine, without the Crimea back then at the time, and also extended towards the border of what is now Moldova. Now, this Alexander Dugin has his political thinking with his Republic of Novorossiya, which is stretching from Russia into the whole northern part of the Black Sea area and also into the territory of Moldova. And the rumors that are going on, when you see we have the area in Donetsk, which is in the eastern part, is disputed. We have Crimea annexed, which is only a tiny bit more until you are in Odessa. And from Odessa, it's only a small ride into Transnistria, where already Russian troops are standing because they act as a peacekeeping force for the war that Iris mentioned between Transnistria and Moldova. So I'm not trying to indicate that the Russian Federation is behind all of this and staging revolutions in order to gain influence, but I am saying that Vladimir Putin is a very smart man, and he is probably the most Machiavellian politician that we see in nowadays, and he seizes opportunity. The basic thinking of Machiavelli was you have to actually see Fortuna, because she has her hair drawn into her face. You have to recognize her. When you see her, you grab her by the head, you grab occasione, the opportunity. And this is something that Vladimir Putin is very good at, and we will see what actually the whole process that is going on, is happening in Chisinau, but also in Ukraine, is going to mean for this future of the EU-Russia relations, which then also already concludes our lecture. So the question that we have to ask ourselves is Russia going to be a reliable energy supplier? We have had a shutdown already, it was in 2006, it was in 2009. Ukraine couldn't pay their gas bills, so Ukraine is the transit country that delivers gas to Western Europe. And we can see in this cartoon the different stars of the European Union flag that are reacting completely different, because there is no proper unified European Union foreign policy and also no proper unified European Union energy policy. But the additionally to that, we can see now that the war with Ukraine hasn't made the situation easier for the Russian Federation, but at the same time the Russian Federation needs money from those natural resources exports. Now, the gas price is attached to the oil price, so a low oil price also means that the gas price is dropping down, and revenues have to be made for in order to have a even budget in the Russian Federation. We can also ask ourselves, is the Russian Federation a partner in security? A cartoon from 2008, and that is already a hint that gives us, because at that time Vladimir Putin was prime minister, although foreign relations are part of the job description of the Russian president, Vladimir Putin is on this cartoon. In the middle you can see former French president Nicolas Sarkozy, who was at that time mediating the conflict, because France had the six-month presidency of the Council of the European Union. And on the left side you can see the then Prime Minister of Georgia, Mikhail Saakashvili, who is currently, interestingly enough, he was ousted in Georgia and is now the governor of Odessa in Ukraine. And also, of course, the question we can ask is if there is going to be democratic development, and the cartoon that I brought where Barack Obama, US President, meets with Dmitry Medvedev and Vladimir Putin, and they both say, like, I'm him and I is he. At the time when it was a question, who is going to run for president? And the interesting part is that, you know, when you look at African states, the presidents that want to be there for a lifetime, they just do it. They change the constitution and say, like, I'm the only savior of that country, I will be there. In the Russian case, they actually stick to the constitution. They alter the constitution. They have the majority to alter the constitution. They did it. They prolonged the term of the Duma, the parliament, and the president, but they didn't change the rule that you can only run for two times. But what they did is step down, Putin stepped down, Medvedev becomes president, Medvedev appoints Putin as prime minister, and then there are rumors who is running for president. Is it going to be Medvedev for a second term, or is it going to be Putin who is technically allowed to run again because the constitution doesn't say that you can't run anymore. So, what does Vladimir Putin do? He gets up on stage and says, like, Dmitry, I accept that I will run for president, but only if you become my prime minister. So there's a lot of effort put into this to actually seem like a democratic state, although they describe themselves as something that needs this tight grip in order to be able to run this huge country. So, a couple of more cartoons that I brought you, where we can see that the future of the EU-Russia relations are something that are really a defining moment for the whole near abroad, as it is called by the Kremlin. So you can see that, again, we had in the very beginning tanks running through Georgia and the Russian the European Union standing by and saying, like, yeah, they will retreat. We see the same case in Ukraine, European Union bureaucrat who is standing there and saying that he's glad that they are still talking. Another one that is referring to this tiny green man that are entering Ukraine. Yeah, we can see those convoys. There were humanitarian convoys sent by the Kremlin to eastern Ukraine to save the poor people that are there. And when they are stopped at the border, this cartoon depicts the driver who says, like, I'm with Russian without borders, supplying humanitarian aid, and tiny green man going on vacation. An interesting thing is when I was in Moldova last year, we went to one of the biggest wine cellars in the world, probably. So there's a rumor that former Russian astronaut Yuri Gagarin was lost for a couple of days in that cellar when he visited. It's massive, it's huge, and the red wine from Moldova is delicious. So, not many people know that, but it is really, really good. And the Moldovan red wine from that cellar in Krikova is exported to the whole world. Yeah? You can see every light with the flag next to it represents a country where it is sent to. So, it is not well known, but the ones who know it really like it, and they are exported. What you can see is there is a red light. And when you look at the flag of Ukraine, never mind, up there, the blue-yellow flag. So there is a red light where it is the capital of the Russian Federation, Moscow. And there is another red light, because they told me that it's so big, they actually had two flags in the Russian Federation, but they took it out, because after Moldova signed the association agreement with the European Union, a ban on various goods, among them wine, was coincidentally in place at the same time, because due to the lack of the quality of the wine. Now, when you continue in that wine cellar in Krikova, you find something very interesting, because there are several politicians who have their own collection, but this is Vladimir Putin's own personal wine collection in Krikova that is still resting there. It's his, at his disposal. But at the same time, the quality of that wine is apparently now so bad that it is no longer allowed to be exported to the Russian Federation. Anyway, we conclude now with the initial question that I asked you, who is more dangerous? So, when we asked, is Assad or Putin more dangerous, I heard Putin. When we asked if Assad or Merkel is more dangerous, I heard mostly saying Assad. When we asked the question, who is more dangerous, Merkel or Putin, again, we responded with Putin. So, at the end, that gives us the conclusion that Vladimir Putin is more dangerous, right? So everyone agrees. Yeah? Wrong. Those people are more dangerous than all of them. Why? We told you a lot of things that you probably never heard before about a country that you didn't realize actually exists, and also about the Orange Revolution in the Euromaidan in Ukraine. You heard it from a point of view that we bring to you. Now, why is this dangerous? When we would be scholars coming from the Russian Federation and not from Germany, or from Syria and the whole Assad area, we would present you the whole things in a completely different way. And now, what we are trying to do, and what is our mission also at SSC Europe, is to make sure that you understand how political processes function, that you understand how alternative approaches to political systems can be done, because this is only the possibility when you are actually capable of understanding how those processes work. But then, at the same time, what we tell you is not necessarily the truth. We give you information. You can do with this information whatever you want, but use this information. Use your points that you heard. We live in an age where it is easier than ever before to get all the information in the world that we want, and then we use it to Google pictures of cats. So use this information that you got, use the things that we told you, challenge them, verify them, and you can start with by asking us questions. And thank you very much for your attention. A couple of things that give you a start for more information are a couple of papers that I have written, and we would have loved to bring you the actual forthcoming book, where Iris and I wrote a book chapter titled like this lecture, Grey is Not a Color. But the good thing is that we couldn't bring it with us because it wasn't published yet when we left for Bangkok. The thing is going to be online, available anyways. And if you need information for that, just contact me via Facebook, via the website, or via email, as ever you like. So, thank you very much for listening to us, and we are looking forward to your questions.
Thank you so much, Basti and Iris. Well, you know, students, I've been thinking for a whole month what Graham means. And I didn't realize that he means a gray hair. So the important thing that the two professors tried to tell us is that the way of demonstrations in Ukraine and in Moldova is different. Because in Ukraine, you see the younger generation, which is affected a lot by the social networks of the Facebook that mobilize 20,000 of them to come to the Maidan Square. But in the case of Moldova, it's very special because it's gray. Because they were 50 years old up, right? And this is more on transparency. Maybe we can relate to Thai demonstration as well, because we got also demonstrations of a different size. Because the money is gone, right? Because the money of the bank was gone to nowhere, to the oligarchs. So it reminds me that the situation in Greece, when they have protests 2 years ago, because a certain number of them are the pensioners, and they're going to be affected a lot if the money or the retirement benefit will be cut off. So in Greek, it's also quite age in terms of demonstration. Before opening questions to the student, I got very important, my another VIP friend. He's a director of the Geschwister Scholl Institute für Politikwissenschaft. Okay. So, Professor Lars Korte is equal to Dean of the Faculty of Political Science of LMU or University of Munich. And LMU is ranking the best in political science every year in Germany. Okay. Now, well, Lars, he knows a lot about EU-Russia relations. He comes to teach for us and go for the MA class. Maybe you can give students more insights. Thank you.
Yes.
The chair does not do as I want. Okay. Yes, thank you very much. Thank you for the presentation. I'm sorry that I joined a little bit late. I have to correct you a little bit because they are much more experts on EU-Russia relations than I can ever be if you look at the publication list. I do not have a publication list like this about EU-Russian relations at all. But however, I would like to pose a question to you about your last part about EU-Russian relations and the future of EU-Russian relations. And to put it a little bit into a bigger picture in Europe, with all this conflict about Moldavia and Moldova and Ukraine, as a bigger picture, do we see or do you see a kind of East-West conflict emerging in Europe on a European scale, not on a global scale as before the East-West conflict, but on a European scale between the EU and Russia, and as a consequence of such a East-West conflict, to see a kind of bipolar order emerging in Europe that would structure Europe for some time to come? Or is it more like, from your perspective, is it more like, I think a Finnish politician, I'm not quite sure if he was Finnish, said some days ago that Russia would be finished in 18 months. And so this would not be, following this, this would not be a structural element that we have to consider in Europe to have a bipolar order in the future. So this would then just be kind of episode. But is it more than this? This is the question. If you look at the bigger picture in Europe, do we see something like the bipolar structure emerging in Europe with those two poles on each side of the West and the East?
Well, thank you, Lars, for the question. It's quite curious that we have to fly to Bangkok to meet here. We haven't managed to do this in a couple of years, and now we're in Thailand to do this. Anyway, this is how it functions in a globalized world. And thank you very much for the question. I think that we have a similar scenario as it had been in the high times of the East-West conflict, with very polarized opinions, with also the Russian Federation experiencing the same problems as the Soviet Union at the high times, where they potentially run out of money because of the low oil price. But I wouldn't see it as a new bipolar order in Europe, because we have a fractured European Union. The European Union might as well collapse within the next 18 months when we look at the upcoming referendum on the Brexit, terrible word, exit of Great Britain from the European Union. And there is no clear unifying points that we had in the East-West conflict, where the West would gather behind the United States to fight communism, where the Soviet Union would unite countries to fight capitalism and bring socialism to the world and make the world the heaven on earth or whatever. So there is no uniting goal on neither sides. Because when you look at the conflict that started the whole Ukrainian mess that we are in now, it was always trying to be in between both sides, but then when they had to choose sides, they break apart. So I don't see a new bipolar order in Europe. I see that we have many, many, many fractions, and I am actually very much afraid, much more afraid of the problems that the European Union will face, the internal ones, than ever a threat could be posed from the Russian Federation, because there is no power behind that idea of a Eurasian Union other than being Putin's brainchild.
Okay,
Anis,
you want to respond to that? Okay. Students, any questions? Raise your hand.
Hi, my name is Nara Huang Yidirong. I come from third year political science. Actually, my English is not good, but I just want to ask, because there's a question coming up on my mind in terms of demonstration in Moldova. I was wondering, what is your opinion? What do you think is the main factor contribute to the fact that there's only gray-haired people coming and protest? When there's a huge problem like money loss and corruption and problems like corruptions, money loss, which I think is problem concerning to everyone. Where is the youngster? Thank you.
Thank you for the question. I think the point is, I had the same question when I was there. So why are there no young people? And I asked, for example, my former students and my colleagues, and they said, yeah, we don't go to the street because we don't know for whom we go. So is it anti-corruption, is it anti-oligarchs, but we know that some of the protesters, they are paid by oligarchs. So, for example, Usati, he pays like 5 euro maybe for one night in a cold tent? And is it really a revolution? Is it a protest if it's for money? And they said, we don't want to stand there and maybe it's getting violent and then we are on the street, but we are on the street for the people in the really nice big houses. And that's why they don't want to share. Maybe this will change now because of the situation last week. So maybe the young people now recognize that it's really worth to go and to change. But how it was before, they didn't.
Well, we got 15 minutes left for questions. Maybe we can have like a couple of questions.
Okay, hello, my name is On, I'm from European Studies. Actually, I have a question about Eurasian Union. I just want to know your opinion about this union. And of course, when you say that, when you mention that they see Baltic country as a opposition candidate, so why do you think Baltic country would like to join them? Because they are already in the European Union.
Thank you very much. So, first of all, my opinion about the Eurasian Union. So, as I said, this is some sort of, I described the process of how Putin became president. And now, normally, when you run for office, you have an agenda, you want to convince your voters, because you might have competitors. In the Russian case, you do not have real competitors. There are people running, but it's clear that Putin will win this election. So his election campaign, so to say, was part of this idea to form this Eurasian Union. And now it dates back to, as I said, 1994, when, again, Nursultan Nazarbayev, the president of Kazakhstan, would actually claim that this would make sense to have this. Yeah? Now you can see about the influence that this president has about his country, because he's still president. It's sort of I would call it phantom pain of the loss of the Soviet Union. And this is what I wanted to illustrate with the slide when I included the Baltic states. I didn't make that slide, actually. I just Googled it. They included them, and it illustrates for me this idea, okay, we want to regain the Soviet Union with this, because when you look at potential targeting countries, they're all former Soviet countries, and none of the Baltic states are going to join a Eurasian Union, because you would have to leave the European Union, which is now possible since the Treaty of Lisbon, but they don't want this. Nobody wants this in those countries. But there are, Latvia, for instance, has a huge Russian-speaking minority. And when I talked about this Machiavellian approach from Putin, it also includes this tactic to say that we need to protect citizens of our country. I think that when I met with a representative from the Ministry of Defense in Moscow, I was asking him about, at that time the Syria war was only in its first year, and it wasn't foreseeable that it would turn out into this complete horrible scenario that we have now. There was a blocking from the Russian Federation side in the United Nations Security Council to actually do something about Syria. So I was asking this representative why. It's always very interesting how Russian politicians are trying to sell their reasons. No different than the West, yeah? Still keep in mind what I said at the end. But nevertheless, from my point of view, it's very interesting. The point was that he said, we need to protect Russian citizens. And I didn't know until then that there are 300,000 Russian passport holders in Syria, probably not now anymore, but they used to be, due to the close ties, that the Soviet Union had with the Assad regime, also already with his father. So this approach of trying to protect national citizens poses a theoretical threat to countries like Latvia, although it is much, much, much smaller, since it is a member of NATO, than it is, for instance, in the case of Moldova, where you have the same amount of Russian passport holders, and Eastern Ukraine, same scenario all over.
Questions? Can you come in front?
Hi, Ken.
But not for the video.
Not enough.
Oh.
Yeah.
Maybe we're in Europe always.
So I was in second year political science. So I have heard about Yulia Tymoshenko. Like, she was some of the key actor in a crisis in Ukraine, but I'm not really know who she is and how does she have an impact in a crisis in Ukraine. So would you please answer that? Thank you.
Thank you. She's very superstar.
Yeah, used to be. Yes. It's kind of like Britney Spears. She was a superstar in the 90s and then she disappeared. And Tymoshenko was a superstar in 2004 with the Orange Revolution. She was one the symbol of the Orange Revolution, and she continued to actually play a role in the political process. But how did Ukraine actually make all these steps towards the Russian Federation when they actually had already a revolution back in 2004. So Tymoshenko ousted, not ousting, competing against Yanukovych, who was then ousted in the Euromaidan of the Revolution of Dignity. They were political rivals. So she was prime minister, then they lost the parliamentary elections, Yanukovych became prime minister, and then they ran to become president, and she lost again, and subsequently also was imprisoned, where they wouldn't let her leave because she wanted to get treatment in Germany, and they were afraid that she would seek for asylum and whatsoever. Anyways, so for the revolution itself, maybe in the upcoming days to the Facebook post, there were rumors about what is going to happen, and is the EU going to exert pressure on Yanukovych because she is in prison, etc., etc. But then it turned out that when she wanted to re-enter the political stage, the Ukrainian people didn't actually want her to, because they felt she was also part of this ancien regime that they want to get rid of. So she was part of the political class. She was an oligarch, or still is. I don't know if she got the money back that they seized and whatever. So her role in the Euromaidan revolution, especially compared to the Orange Revolution, is tiny, tiny, tiny. But there are rumors, because we will see local elections in Ukraine very soon, and there are rumors that she is trying to re-enter the stage to build on the basis, because especially in more rural areas, the people are still more towards the established politicians, because there are rumors spread that in Kiev all these people are neo-Nazis who took over and we have to fight them, etc. So this could be a ground where Tymoshenko could win in some local elections, which then would bring her back on stage, because the current prime minister in Ukraine is not very well respected from the people anymore, and I could imagine that she will try to re-enter the political scene, which then brings us, I would say, into the spiral that we have seen over and over again. Because the point is, normally I would say, and I have said it after the Orange Revolution, it's a sign of a democratization of a country when the government is voted out of office and a different government comes into power. Even if it is the one who actually caused the Orange Revolution with Yushchenko. But when we have this case here again, then we might see a new Euromaidan in 1 year or whatsoever. And when I speak to the people from those NGOs that I mentioned that came out of this Euromaidan area, they say when nothing changes, when old people are trying to come back, when there is no clear reform because corruption is high there as well, when there is nothing done, then there will be the next Maidan because we are fed up, we have our structures, and we're going to come back. What we would need is a scenario that we can see in Georgia, where it is actually an effort to bring and clean out what has happened. We had a colorful revolution as well, 2003. Something that I didn't know very much is that, nevertheless, during all this appraised democratization attempts under Saakashvili, we have seen a rise in political prisoners in Georgia that is unprecedented and has a rise in figures that we could only experience in the times when Hitler seized power in Germany. So that has to be cleared out, this revolution that happened there. But then I mentioned Saakashvili's new job is now being governor of Odessa. There are even rumors, because he is one of the highest respected politicians amongst Ukrainians, because in their perception, the guy is Georgian, so he can't be corrupt in the Ukrainian system, right? So there are even rumors that he might become prime minister, and I don't think that those people who drove the Euromaidan will take this very well. But I'm also not sure if they are able to pull it off, and that will tear one more time, and that will tear that country apart. So, sorry, I kind of drifted off from Tymoshenko. Bottom line is, her role was very small, and I hope that it doesn't increase in the future because it will only lead towards a downward spiral.
One or two more questions? Well, okay, so let me say thank you again, and could we have an applause for the board of being a very insight, because they were in the errors and following their updated demonstrations. And last week, just something happened in Moldova as well. Okay, and we hope if you come for holiday or if you come for any other missions, kindly visit us again, okay? It's a pleasure to be having you too. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, I would like to end the lecture today. Thank you, students. Okay, goodbye.